I'm Katie Massad, and this is Flute Unscripted, candid conversations with musicians, makers, and masters. I sit down with a new artist every week and share their uncensored stories with you. You're listening to Season 1, brought to you by Flute Center of New York, the exclusive marketplace for flutes. Join us and subscribe, and please stay tuned to the end of the episode for a special Flute Center of New York code for our podcast listeners. Canadian flutist Dr. Connor Nelson began his studies on the flute not quite sure of where it would lead him. He followed his passion nonetheless and made the journey into a coveted tenure-track teaching position look effortless. Connor is a graduate of Manhattan School of Music, Yale University, and Stony Brook University, where he won all three concerto competitions. He has a number of solo and chamber competitions under his belt, including the Thomas Neifinger Prize, the Samuel Baron Prize, and the Presser Award. He has appeared as soloist with major orchestras, given masterclasses across the country at over 100 institutions, and is associate professor of flute at Bowling Green State University. Connor shares with me that alongside hard work, he has found success from others taking risks on him and from mastering the trick of faking it till you make it. Such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Oh yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
One of the things I wanted to chat with you a lot about is the doctoral experience, because I feel like you're a shining example of what it is to be a modern flutist now. You've kind of followed the trajectory of going through school all the way through undergrad, master's, doctorate, teaching, successfully soloing. You know, that's pretty unusual and unique to have a smooth transition all the way throughout. Why do you think that is so difficult for most people? And do you think your situation was based on luck a lot, or were there certain things that you think gave you a leg up? It's a loaded question.
Well, there are so few teaching positions, if that's, you know, that's definitely what gave me my first, you know, in. Mm-hmm. Is that a school in Oklahoma decided they would trust someone who was 25 to teach at their school. So I had no idea what I was even applying for at the time. The ad for that tenure track job said 9 months. So I figured, oh, I'll just go there for 9 months and maybe come back to New York City.
Yeah.
Got nothing else better to do.
And then your life changed after that.
Yeah, I was sitting there in the interviews with the department head, and she was like, so in your second year this, your third year this, your fourth year this, and I was kind of like, so I was definitely a little bit clueless how all that worked. And I think there's so many fantastic people, and there's just so few positions.
Yeah.
You know, I asked the folks, you know, in Oklahoma, like, what it was about my materials, and they said, well, you did things outside of school. So, and then, so I guess that would be
a big series. You're making your own
opportunities. You have to do things outside of school.
Right. And did you always know that you wanted to follow that path into teaching at the at collegiate level, or were you just kind of winging it?
Well, you know, certainly at the beginning, it seemed like a much better choice than moving home to Canada and working at Starbucks.
Right.
So
take any opportunity you can get.
Yeah, it was a pretty easy one.
Yeah.
You know, so there was one student evaluation she wrote when I was like my first year in Oklahoma. It seems like he doesn't really care about this at all, and he is just here to further his career. And I was like, ooh. Well, she's got a point.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Did that make you change your teaching style after that evaluation?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, like, you know, it was part of that job of, that's what it is, though. It's like 50% or 35% or whatever of the job description actually is going out to perform in. Doing that, so I think, you know, she maybe also didn't understand that.
Yeah. Because you have to also make a name for yourself to recruit. Do you feel like there's pressure to recruit?
Well, pre-tenure, if you are not successful with attracting students in both, who are both prepared and in the quantity said institution would like, you will likely lose your job.
Yeah.
So I would say yes.
Yeah. High pressure.
Yeah. Definitely.
What do you think are some of the merits and challenges of pursuing a doctorate?
Oh, well, we need great citizens of the arts and music. You know, it's a fantastic, you know, experience to go through. You know, if you're, I would say if you're someone who knows no matter what, you want to stay in music for as long as possible. Perhaps it's another great avenue there to do so, building connections and building a life somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, it's certainly not for everyone.
Do you think a lot of people just fall into it because they're not sure what to do next after a master's, if they don't have anything lined up? And do you think that's a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, you know, for me, like, I needed another student visa to stay in the country.
Yeah.
So, and I didn't have enough to support myself,
mm-hmm.
you know, at that point, even if I didn't, even if I was a citizen of the United States.
Yeah.
So, sometimes it's, you know, I guess it's just a myriad of different possibilities and everyone is a little bit different. So
yeah.
It would really, really, you know, depend,
hmm.
you know, certainly, you know, you walk into a DMA, hopefully knowing that, like, with the one traditional, like, employment avenue
right.
for that degree
mm-hmm.
is evaporating.
Yep.
And there, even before, you know, colleges and universities were losing tenure track lines in music.
Throughout your education, you studied with Carol Winsentz, Ransom Wilson, Linda Chassis, Susan Hepner. They're all rock stars in the flute world, right? Mm-hmm. Big personalities, all different teaching styles, playing styles. How do you think they shaped you as a musician? And do you think it's important to study with a range of different teachers?
Oh, well, absolutely. I think it takes a village to raise a musician,
mm-hmm.
for sure. And I think that wide-ranging kind of diversity I had with the scope of teachers that I was lucky to have was certainly a huge positive for me. There was certainly some moments where it was confusing right at the beginning.
Yeah.
I was like, really? Wow! So, but, you know, I think it's shaped me in that, you know, I'm generally now not a person of right ways of doing things and wrong ways of doing things for myself. Or for my students,
mm-hmm.
so it's more a building of, you know, of interpretive tools and tools to help, like, craft one's technique and playing,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a far more personalized way, so.
Do you think that that transition was hard for you, student to professional, because it was in such a short amount of time, or did you trust yourself immediately in?
Oh, I was freaking out.
Yeah.
I had no idea what on earth I was doing.
Mm-hmm. And how did you cope?
You know, you just have a little cry in the car on the way home from the gym one night, you know? But, you know, of course, a huge culture shock, right? When you, you know,
yeah.
are on the East Coast, you know, and then go to the middle of the country where everything is different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a music school and it's not a music school, it's not a music school. You know, just
yeah.
what are the expectations and what are, you know, and how to work in an entirely different environment. Like, that was probably the most shocking, at least at first, but you figure it out.
When you landed your job at Bowling Green, what was that audition interview process like?
Oh.
Give us the deets.
Well, my good friend Nina Simakopoulos used to teach there, and And she was staying at my apartment the weekend before I left to interview for her job. And somehow my flight was super late and I didn't get in into Bowling Green until like 3 o'clock in the morning. And then we had a whole day of events starting at 8 a.m., you know. Ooh. The rehearsal for the recital being, you know, that morning.
Yeah.
Not in the hall you're playing in.
Right.
You know, and I had a partner teaching at Oberlin, so of course, like, you know, I wanted to be a 2-hour drive versus, like, an all-day excursion with two different plane flights. So
right.
I've almost never been so nervous or wanted anything quite so badly. So, it definitely felt really great, and I knew they had all sorts of resources to have, you know, really, really some great students there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've been so fortunate for that. So, and even just right now, sitting in this room, knowing the three of my BGSU graduates are in the lobby,
mm-hmm.
in the building right now, you know, living
proud
in New York City, that's really cool. That's,
yeah.
really, that's really great. So.
Yeah. Dr. Nelson has been leading the DMA Contemporary Music Flute Program at BGSU and has not only seen his studio mature and develop their knowledge of the repertoire, but felt a shift in his own playing. Connor believes that learning new music is a requirement for any flutist who wants to rightly acknowledge all the repertoire being written today. You are also a champion of contemporary music. You've released a couple albums of new music, and you have some premieres on an album of flute and piano music too.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you to new music in the first place, and why do you think it's important?
Well, we have such a wealth of literature, you know, in comparison to so many other eras throughout, you know, Western music history. So I think if you're a flute player that doesn't play contemporary music, that's just probably not great.
You're missing out on a huge chunk of repertoire.
So much great, great music. And, you know, I have a huge focus on contemporary music at BGSU, but I would say that I just kind of like to do a little bit of everything. And hopefully with contemporary music, I'm just doing my share. But strangely, you know, because I teach there, I think, and then other, you know, happen to play deal of it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I guess people associate with me as like a new music flute, which is fine.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean,
that's
really hard music. Thank you.
You'll take it.
Sure.
But that's not how you associated yourself over the years.
Yeah, that's what, you know, I said that in, I think, my interview with BGSU. Was like, well, I've never been in a contemporary music ensemble,
mm-hmm.
you know, like Ice or Del Niente or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if that's who you're looking for, that's not me. But, you know, being at BGSU for the past 7 or 8 years or something, I've definitely played so much there.
So you've even grown.
Oh, so much in that respect there.
Yeah.
Because we have this big new music festival
mm-hmm.
and, you know, people are throwing stuff at you all the time. You know, even before I got there, they were like, so how about Harold Meltzer's, you know, trap set, alto flute, you know, like, oh, I guess I better get one.
Did you go out and buy an alto flute?
Of course
after
I
that?
Did.
Yeah.
I dumped
Good
out some
you.
Retirement savings
yeah.
and bought an alto flute.
Let's assess our priorities
it's
here.
Like, yeah.
Alto flute, retirement, clearly.
You know, teaching
it's
in
clear
school
choice.
With a DMA in
yeah.
contemporary music, maybe I should have my own
yes.
alto flute.
Yeah. You made the wise choice.
You know.
There are also a lot of staples in the flute repertoire. Especially as a professor, I think it's emphasized that you make sure all your students are equipped with, you know, the French books and, you know, everything that we're supposed to know. Do you think there are contemporary works that should be in our everyday repertoire that we're teaching all of our young students?
How young?
A college.
Right.
Our college students.
Well, I find the level, you know, for college students, quote unquote, varies so dramatically.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
You know, so, but
But you can say that amongst all colleges, it's, you know, you need to know the French book. You need to know your Altes studies. Mm-hmm. You obviously know the Taffanel and Gobert. Bach. I mean, those are your staples.
Yeah, what would if you're they be? A music performance major, my goodness, of course.
Oh, yes, of course. But so. Is there like a baseline of contemporary works that you think, even at varying levels, everyone should study these works as a part of their repertoire?
Yes.
What would they be? I'm so curious. I need to know if I'm up to snuff.
Well, if it's someone's first foray into mm-hmm. contemporary music, then it's probably a good idea to start with solo pieces by flutist composers that have written things idiomatically.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, usually when that freshman first sees, you know, Will Offerman's Honami, and the eyes turn into big, huge saucers, you know.
Yeah, it's another language, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just like, oh, sweetheart, this is nothing.
Yeah. I wish when I was younger that I was introduced, yeah, just to the notation alone a little bit sooner so that I could have adapted to reading new music, because it is another language and you have to be quick on your feet. And if you're not familiar with all the notation and all the little tricks that are in there, and you have to keep looking things up of what does that mean and what am I supposed to do there? Yeah. And then that's time consuming and slows you down.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's like the obvious pieces like Barrio Sequenza
mm-hmm.
that, you know, one should do.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I kind of grow wary of like, well, this is a list of things that everyone needs to know and do. It's just like, well, why don't we take them where they are and take them as far as we possibly can?
Do you feel like that's a naive approach to have the book of repertoire and just learn it, and that you should tailor the repertoire to the student and their abilities instead?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And like performances they have coming up and competitions and stuff. You know, like, I never learned pieces just for the fun of it. Starting in undergrad, there's no time for that. It all has to be for a recital.
Yeah.
Or a competition, or to play at some class or something.
Do you think it makes you learn the repertoire differently when you have a purpose for performing it versus just learning?
Oh, yeah. Especially for me. There's far more... just a drive to simply not embarrass myself, right?
Yeah.
Like, people are going to hear this.
Yeah. Speaking of competitions and making your students be active about competing, you yourself have been extremely successful with competitions. Is there some sort of gearing up into competition mode that you do, some regimen that you have that puts you in competition mode? Or are you just so used to it now, it's like, oh, another competition here, there, I've got this.
Well, I guess I haven't done a competition in maybe a decade.
Mm-hmm. At the start of your career.
Yeah. Though. Well, they were just, you know, there was so many I didn't win. And those ones that I didn't win, I think, were the best preparation. They were the regimen, right? Because even though I didn't win, no one can take that work away from you
mm-hmm.
that you put in. And it meant I was ready, you know, for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
So, that much more. So, because I had so many, like, deadlines on the fire.
Yeah.
So, all of those competitions meant I was ready for that, you know, interview recital at Oklahoma State. On 2 weeks' notice. Bam! Yeah. Go!
Did you ever have a really disheartening competition experience where it was something that you really felt like you poured your heart into and it didn't go the way that it didn't result in the way you thought it should have? Maybe you thought you should have won and
never say I thought that I should have won, but certainly doing competitions is disheartening.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is horrible.
Mm-hmm. And how do you pick yourself back up right after?
You go to, you have something else that's coming up and you have no choice.
Yeah.
You've got something else on the books.
Yeah.
You know, move so you're on. Not like sitting around wallowing for months. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're just so busy that like, oh, well, I have to start learning this now.
Do you think you've matured a lot as a flutist?
Maybe. I hope so. you know, there's always a couple steps forward and a couple steps back. And, like, when folks told me that, you know, you'll never have as much time to practice as when you're in school, I was like, oh, pshaw, have you have you seen my schedule? And now I'm like, oh.
Maybe they're right a little bit.
So,
is that? Do you think it's important to then store up your bank of practicing when you're young? Is that advice that you'd give to your students? Is put in the time now, because it does get harder as you get older.
Well, I probably wouldn't, you know, say that. But if you want this, you're gonna have to work really hard forever.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today.
Well, thank you.
You can hear Connor Nelson's hard work come to life on his CDs, Breaking Training and Nada Raja, released by New Focus Recordings. Better yet, if you get a chance, hear Dr. Nelson perform live and play for him in a masterclass in a city near you. Thank you, Connor Nelson. Music selections are from his album Nada Raja and featured Archetypes by Corey Ryan, and Dances Vaj by Josh Levine. This has been an episode of Flute Unscripted. This podcast is sponsored by the Flute Center of New York. Visit their website at flutesforsale.com for the largest selection of new and pre-owned instruments. Use this season's promo code LISTEN for a special deal of $50 off any purchase of $4.99 or more. You can follow the Flute Center on Instagram and like them on Facebook to stay up to date on the latest events and masterclasses. Special thanks to our owner, Phil Unger, the Flute Center team, and Stefan Huskoldsen for our theme music.